The next case on the docket this morning is United States versus Brantley. Our counsel ready? Okay. We will hear first from the appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Matthew Hallandoni. Captain Joshua Grubaugh and I represent the appellant, Private First Class Mitchell Brantley. The government's statutory analysis of Article 120, evaluation of the evidence, and its ultimate charging decision in this case were insufficient. As a result, PFC Brantley's conviction for abusive sexual contact when SR was otherwise unaware is legally insufficient and should be set aside and dismissed. This court's decision in Sager effectively forecloses the government's argument that asleep, unconscious, and otherwise unaware are the same theory of liability. There is no evidence in the record supporting the theory the government charged and presented to the fact finder that SR was otherwise unaware, which means unaware in a manner different from asleep and different from unconscious. The legal insufficiency of PFC Brantley's conviction is the direct result of how the government chose its theory of liability when it drafted the charge. This conviction could be legally sufficient under other theories of liability, just not the one the government selected and the panel was instructed.
Counsel, isn't the appellant here his own worst enemy? You've got these three baskets that you're just referring to in terms of being asleep, unconscious, otherwise unaware. Appellant is stating in his testimony, essentially, well, she was restless, she was initiating some sexual conduct. When asked about whether she was unconscious, she said, well, not really. So he's the one who seems to be ruling out unconscious.
Well, Your Honor, you have two versions. You obviously have the SR's version, in which she says, I was passed out, which emphasized to her by the trial counsel meant that she was unconscious. And you have PFC Brantley's version. But PFC Brantley's version, if a rational fact finder took his version and believed his version, he would be fully acquitted because his testimony would either show that SR was aware of the sexual contact by her actions or that he at least had a reasonable mistake of fact as to consent related to that. The central theme of the government's case.
Is it that stark of a situation where at the appellate level we're looking at it whether any rational trier of fact could make that determination? Couldn't a rational trier of fact look at his statements in regard to the victim's conduct and then look at other testimony out there in regard to his understanding about how many shots she took of alcohol, the fact that she was vomiting violently in reaction to the medication, even if he didn't know what that medication was, to then say, hey, she must not have known what was going on here?
Your Honor, I think that evidence could support a theory of liability that she might have been incapable of consent due to impairment from the alcohol and the drugs. But that's a separate theory under Article 120B3A than what was charged in this case, which was otherwise unaware. And just because she was impaired doesn't mean that she was unaware of what was going on based on that evidence.
Well, let me just clarify here. So is it, in fact, your bottom line position that they just used the wrong statute to charge him?
They chose the wrong theory of liability, Your Honor. Within 120B2 and also didn't charge 120B3.
So
it's a variance case.
It's not a variance case, Your Honor. A variance applies to facts, not law or theory of liability. And also, it's not a variance case, as this court said in Lebaski, because there were no findings by exceptions and substitutions. This is simply, is the charge as drafted legally sufficient?
No, there can be a variance between what's charged and the theory that's adduced at trial. That's a variance.
Well, Your Honor, at the same time, the other theories, such as incapable of consent or asleep or unconscious, were not presented to the fact finder. They were not instructed upon. The instruction only mentioned the words otherwise unaware and didn't incorporate the rest of the other theories that were possible.
So in your view, what does this is a hard question. What does otherwise unaware mean?
Your Honor, some examples I could come up with is someone's paralyzed from the waist down and they're unaware that someone's touching them sexually. It's meant to cover things, as this court said in Sager, different from asleep and different from unconscious.
Does it mean, or doesn't it mean, impairment by any drug or intoxicant?
No, Your Honor, I think that that is specifically set out in Article 120B3A as a separate theory of liability. That's what should, if that's the evidence that the government believed they have, that's what they should have charged in this case. And they could have had a legally sufficient conviction if that was the case, but that's what not what they chose here. Now, there's also some evidence in the record that SR was asleep or unconscious. SR testified that PFC Brantley sent her a text message that he touched her breast while she was sleeping. And she also testified that she does not remember this incident at all because she was passed out, which, again, two times in the record, the trial counsel asked her, what does that mean to you? And she emphasized that she meant she lost consciousness. But there is no evidence of this separate theory of otherwise unaware, some state other than asleep or unconscious. Now, the government thought that by charging otherwise unaware, it was picking a theory that subsumed incapable of consent due to impairment under Article 120B3A. The trial counsel did not merely argue that it was circumstantial evidence of impairment. He made it the central theme of his case. At numerous points in his argument, he emphasized that being otherwise unaware simply meant being incapable of consent due to impairment, and he even displayed visual aids to hammer home this point to the panel. This was an incorrect view of the law on numerous levels. As my colleagues on appeal concede at page 23 of their brief, a charge under this theory would require the government to prove not only a lack of awareness, but also the inability to consent. And for this reason, Congress has listed these theories in separate statutory provisions of Article 120. Evidence of SR's impairment alone does not meet the government's burden to prove she was otherwise unaware.
How does Sager support your case?
Your Honor, as the majority of the briefs show, which were written pre-Sager, it answers the statutory analysis question that was originally presented here. It answers that asleep, unconscious, and otherwise unaware within Article 120B2 are separate theories of liability. That was the government's position they took in their brief, is that it's just one similar to what the government took in Sager, and it's been effectively foreclosed at this point by Sager. The longstanding Supreme Court principle in Chiarella, adopted by this court in Riley and Ober, is that an appellate court may not affirm a conviction based on a theory of liability not presented to the fact finder. The military judge only instructed the panel on the theory that SR was otherwise unaware. Nowhere in his instructions are the words asleep or unconscious or incapable of consent due to impairment mentioned. Therefore, this court may not affirm this conviction as it was charged, even if there is some evidence supporting those other theories in the record. This court certainly shouldn't affirm a theory that the government didn't understand or wasn't even trying to prove, as they were in this case. Now, the government argues that even if the panel convicted PFC Brantley on evidence that SR was asleep or unconscious, this does not constitute a material variance. And variance has not and never has been, or has not been and is not, the issue in this case, because the military judge never made any findings by exceptions and substitutions. In fact, he specifically told the government that there was no possibility for variance and that such an instruction was not appropriate, to which the government, the trial counsel, agreed, and that's at Joint Appendix 265. The issue in this case has always been whether the government proved SR was otherwise unaware as charged. This case is like Lebaski, where this court need only determine whether the government proved the theory it selected beyond a reasonable doubt. And it has not in this case.
Does otherwise unaware include like a combination of these things, even if a person is not completely unconscious, they might be kind of in some twilight area? What about that? I mean, in other words, you've indicated that the government should have charged this under an impairment theory, under a different part of Article 120, right?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not telling the government how to charge
these
cases.
Suggesting, let's say that.
I'm saying that had they charged it differently, there's possibilities that there's possibilities that this could be legally sufficient. We certainly don't agree that the evidence was strong enough to convict under any theory of
But back to my question about the category of otherwise unaware, are you discounting the fact that you could have kind of a combination of all these different states, although not one of these states is fully present? Now, you could be kind of impaired, you could be kind of come in and out of consciousness, you could be impaired enough by drugs or alcohol or both, like this victim is said to have been, and still, wouldn't all of that together make someone otherwise unaware? And I'm asking, I'm not dictating.
Your Honor, my understanding of this court's decision in Sager, in which this court says, under a plain reading of this language, the words otherwise unaware mean unaware in a manner different from asleep and different from unconscious, separates those three without any overlap within Article 120b2. Now, with regards to impairment can certainly
show. A big word can mean a whole lot of things, right? Impairment?
It can, but they can't simply show that the alleged victim was impaired. They have to show that they were, in fact, unaware as a result. So it's not just being impaired. That's not a theory of liability.
No, I understand.
They've got an additional burden to show the lack of awareness. Now, the government claims that PFC Brantley is not prejudiced if this court finds evidence that SR was asleep. That evidence of sleep is different from being otherwise unaware, which, in fact, it did in Sager. The Supreme Court held in numerous cases, and particularly in Garner versus Louisiana, that it is as much a violation of due process to send an accused to prison following a conviction for a charge that was never made as it is to convict him upon a charge from which there is no evidence to support that conviction. And that's what happened in this case. PFC Brantley was convicted under the theory SR was otherwise unaware, which means something different than asleep or unconscious, despite there being no evidence of this separate theory. There can be no greater prejudice than this. Because the government did not prove the essential element that SR was otherwise unaware beyond a reasonable doubt, this court should set aside and dismiss the conviction. There is no need to remand to the CCA like this court did in Sager, because there is no indication that the Army Court misinterpreted the law from its summary decision. This court has set aside legally insufficient specifications numerous times in cases like Lubasky, Plant, and this term in Wilson. The prosecution's insufficient analysis and charging decision are the reasons this conviction is legally insufficient. The government simply selected a charge it could not prove and didn't even seem to know it. Accordingly, this court should set aside and dismiss the specification of charge one.
If in fact your legal argument is right, why wouldn't we want to send it back to the CCA to redo their factual sufficiency determination based on the new understanding of the law?
Your Honor, it's certainly a possibility and an option that this court has to do that. We don't believe that it's necessary in this case because, unlike Sager, you don't have multiple theories of liability. You don't have the business of the military judge instructing the panel to select which theory of liability. The government gave the fact finder and the appellate courts one theory of liability to review legal sufficiency under. And it would be much more for judicial economy and much easier than sending it back and allowing the CCA to take another crack at something that they did a one-page summary affirmance on. Pending further questions from the court, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. The court will now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Melissa Dasgupta-Smith, and along with Major Michael Cordy, we represent the United States. The court should affirm the findings as legally sufficient because the appellant knew that the victim was unaware. The most direct evidence of this is at JA 37 when he informed the victim of the sexual contact. Later, PFCDS asked the appellant, "Did you do anything else to my mother? She deserves to know." The appellant responded, "Nothing else," without challenging the premise of that question, that the victim was unaware.
Now, but how does that tell us? It tells us that there's evidence out there that that the victim was unaware. But how does that tell us that she was otherwise unaware, that legal term, as compared to being unconscious and being unaware because she was unconscious?
Yes, Your Honor. This victim was unaware in a manner that is nebulous and undefined and that lies somewhere in between strict sleep and strict unconsciousness. This victim was described as in and out of consciousness at JA 70 to 72 by PFCDS. This victim also had a flash memory of the appellant straddled above her, and the appellant described her as passed out. All of those taken together in combination with the fact that this victim was intoxicated, medicated, sick, and in pain due to a recent hysterectomy 3 weeks prior, that's at JA 59.
But does impaired, which I think the evidence shows that was proven to some degree by alcohol and drug intake, I think the question is that, does that constitute otherwise unaware? Because that's the theory the government used at trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
So to me it's a legal issue as to whether or not they relied on that. They didn't charge it.
Correct, Your Honor. It was not charged. However, it is more the combination of the medication, the intoxication, the fact that she was sick, vomiting, and in pain.
Well, those are all facts in the record. That doesn't really help you when it comes to the legal theory that the government proceeded on, which is you're giving us facts that support the legal theory of impaired equals otherwise unaware, but that doesn't help you with the fact that impaired is a separate statutory provision.
Yes, Your Honor, and it is, in fact, a separate statutory provision, and it could have been charged, and those facts could have gone to support that charge. However, those facts can also support the victim's unawareness.
But don't you think that just as otherwise unaware has to mean something different than asleep or unconscious, it also has to mean something different than impaired, or they wouldn't have separate statutory provisions?
Your Honor, the
or maybe not. I mean, or, tell me what you think.
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence may overlap. The evidence may be evidence that could be considered as impairment. It could have risen to the level of she was unable to consent because she was impaired, but it also can go to show that she was unaware. So just as this court ruled in Rosario, the same evidence can be used to consider different charges.
But it seemed as though what the government was arguing is that because she was impaired, she was otherwise unaware, meaning that they were the same thing.
Your Honor, that in combination with the fact that she didn't know about the offense until the appellant told her about it, and the medication, and the fact that she was in this fog where she has a flash memory where she is described in and out of, you know, in and out.
Well, what does that have to do with whether or not she was impaired? I mean, either she's impaired under that section or she's not. And it seems that the government relied, and it may be perfectly fine, relied on the fact that impairment was the same thing as otherwise unaware.
Your Honor, the government's argument talked extensively about impairment and emphasized the amount of alcohol she consumed, which was a significant amount. It was between 8 to 11 shots within like an hour and a half.
But didn't they talk exclusively about impairment? I mean, that was their argument.
Well, you also said that she was otherwise unaware because she was unconscious, which we know after Sager is not an accurate statement of the law.
Correct, Your Honor. The government also pointed to the medication, Your Honor, and also emphasized the text message that the victim received from the appellant saying, you know, while you were passed out, I touched you. So it is the combination of the fact that she was in fact unaware due to several factors. And although we didn't have a doctor examine her at that moment in time, and there's no evidence on the record of the exact state that she was in, all of those factors combined are circumstantial evidence of the fact that she was unaware.
Well, are they seem to be, or the appellant says that being unaware because you consume too much booze or some medicine is something else. That's a separate statute, and the government has to charge it under that statute. You know, the government's stuck with Sager.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, what do you do?
Your Honor, if if the government had...
What saves this? The fact that she sort of woke up? Or, I mean, it sounds to me like this is nothing but booze and pills. And according to the appellant, you got to charge that under some other rubric.
Your Honor, the statute was drafted broadly to include otherwise unaware being many different situations that cannot
well,
be...
Well, yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about. Otherwise unaware is God knows nebulous. But there's another statute that the appellant keeps citing saying you got to charge, if it's booze and pills, you got to charge it under that statute. And you can't charge it under otherwise unaware. So where are we?
Your Honor, the prosecutor has discretion to choose which statute they believe the evidence supports. And in this case, the primary evidence, the most direct evidence, and the most compelling evidence is the appellant's confession to the victim and the fact that he informed her of the sexual contact. She would have never known that this occurred if he had not sent her.
Well, but that, what does that point to? Unconscious? Asleep? Otherwise, I mean, all that points to is the fact she would have never known. She would have never known how, why. Unconscious, asleep,
impaired.
Blasted, impaired, what? I mean, under Sager, you got to pick something.
She would have never known because she was somewhere in between strict sleep and unconsciousness.
Is that what saves it?
Yes, Your Honor. Because Congress drafted...
If she had just conked out totally, then it wouldn't be saved.
If she was completely unconscious, that could have also been charged, and potentially under these facts, the panel could have found him guilty as of unconscious, but that wasn't charged. And there's facts that support otherwise unaware.
Well, I've got to confess that you kind of lost me there. She's either unconscious or she's otherwise, you're stuck with Sager. She's either unconscious or she's otherwise unaware or she's blasted or something. But what is it? I mean, I think what the government is saying that well, she's unconscious but not quite, so that's otherwise. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And Congress intended to use that otherwise unaware as a broad catch-all for those situations that cannot qualify as strict sleep or strict unconsciousness. To interpret it narrowly as the appellant
continually throughout the trial referred to her as unconscious, drunk, passed out. I mean, so they didn't make these fine distinctions at trial. I mean, would you agree that's slightly problematic for your position today?
Your Honor, at trial, the appellant, through his admission, described her as passed out. The victim herself also said, and then I passed back out. Which
is that passed out typically means unconscious, right?
According to the dictionary, yes, Your Honor, it does. However, in this case, the appellant is not a doctor and neither is the victim. We look to all of the facts in the case to determine what was her actual state. And all of the facts combined indicate that her actual state was somewhere in between. It was something that is not necessarily specifically defined. And because of that, if we were to interpret, as appellant suggests, that otherwise unaware only applies to a person who is paralyzed, that rare circumstance, then that would vitiate that specific portion of the statute, because then all of these hybrid situations, all of these combinations of victims that are tired, that are medicated, that are intoxicated, and that may not necessarily be fully unconscious per the doctor's definition of unconscious, all of those situations would fall without any criminal liability.
Now, would the government agree that this statute fits the scenario here, that the other person is incapable of consenting to the sexual conduct due to impairment by any drug or alcohol? That seems to fit this.
Your Honor, absolutely. Absolutely. They could have charged that, and a rational panel could have found that.
Now, from a notice perspective, don't you think that puts the accused on notice better than being charged with otherwise unaware and yet proving impairment by a drug or intoxicant.
Your Honor, from a notice perspective, the appellant was aware of the charge, as otherwise unaware being a broad charge. There was no request for a bill of particulars. There was no request for an amendment to the charge. There was no request for continuance. So this court can take that into account in determining that there was no notice problem, that the appellant's defense was consent. So any victim who is awake and consenting to the sexual contact, touching the appellant's penis, that victim was aware. So the appellant was defending against aware as charged. A rational panel could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mrs. S.R. was unaware of the sexual contact, especially when drawing every reasonable inference in favor of the prosecution.
How does that differ from a rational panel finding she was unconscious? I mean, I don't see it. And the government's bound by its charging decision. So where are we?
Your Honor, the government could have charged unconscious, and there is some evidence of unconscious.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The government instead charged otherwise unaware, which means potentially in between sleep and unconsciousness. And there's...
Do you think that the government, when they charged it that way, thought that otherwise unaware was a big catch-all that included within it all this other stuff?
I mean, that was the government...
Fairness.
Your Honor, absolutely, that was the government's argument prior to U.S. v. Sager, but there's no evidence on the record that at the charging decision and at the point where the defense made their defense theory and at the point where the judge instructed the panel, at all those points, there's no evidence that the government or the defense or the military judge or the panel were operating off of the assumption that unconscious is subsumed by otherwise unaware. The evidence points to a number of circumstantial factors that were presented combined with the fact that this victim, in fact, did not know of the sexual contact and that he told her about it. That was the main factor, that he informed her of the sexual contact. The plain language of unaware means she didn't know, and that's when it happened. It happened in that fog of her not knowing. And that's what the panel was focused on. In conclusion, the findings are legally sufficient because Mrs. S.R.'s intoxicated, medicated, sick, post-surgical state of being was somewhere in between sleep and unconsciousness and falls under the broad catch-all of otherwise unaware, and the appellant knew this. Pending any questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear rebuttal.
Members of the court, the government argues that the conviction is legally sufficient because PFC Brantley knew the victim was unaware. Well, that seems to be taking the same argument that they took pre-Sager, where before this court separated those into three separate theories of liability. If it was simply charged as when SR was unaware, that would fail to state an offense, especially in light of Sager. The word otherwise was placed in the statute for a specific purpose. That's not by itself a theory of liability. Now, with regard to SR's actual state at the time of the alleged sexual contact. That occurs after she says that she passed out again, that she lost consciousness. Now, there's nobody else there. There's only her and PFC Brantley, and you have these two divergent theories. But taken in the light most favorable to the government, which is what they were trying to elicit at trial, they were trying to elicit that she had lost consciousness. And additionally, the government talks about medical definitions and things like that. The government was trying
counsel,
to get away
what about the government's view that otherwise unaware, that phrase really fits this case very well. It's not a situation where the government needs to shoehorn it in here, that in fact Congress, when it came up with that term, otherwise unaware, could actually have been thinking about precisely this situation where a victim is in this twilight zone of unconsciousness up to a period of being capable of engaging in conduct, back down into this state of unconsciousness that is reflected in the testimony of appellant here, talking about, well, I wouldn't say passed out, I wouldn't say unconscious.
Your Honor, with regard to appellant's testimony, his ultimate testimony is that she was talking, she was moving, she was answering his questions. He's patting her on the back. She says, you don't have to do this. So she's responding to his stimuli and knows that he's there. That shows that she's aware. At the very least, that testimony shows that he had a reasonable mistake of fact as to consent. Now, if you take SR's...
Well, counsel, weren't the members allowed to, and seems like they did, reject his version of the facts in total?
Your Honor, they can completely reject his version of the facts.
Well, it looks like they did.
And then you have SR's version in which she says, I was passed out. And
so, but if she was talking and moving, right, so you said that means that she was aware, but her testimony is that she doesn't remember anything, why isn't that something other than passed out or asleep? I mean, why isn't it like a blackout or a fog or a however?
And, Your Honor, I can point directly in the record at Joint Appendix 57 where the trial counsel is trying to get rid of any evidence of this potential fog or blackout. He says, SR, we are going to just clarify a couple of things. We heard the term blackout and pass out, and you were using pass out, and defense counsel was using blackout. We don't want a medical definition. Pass out, what does that mean to you? To lose consciousness. So she says, unequivocally, I had lost consciousness.
No, but we're doing legal sufficiency here, right? And so we have two different people testifying to two different things. And all I'm asking is a legal question. Why couldn't someone who is talking and appearing to respond that has no recollection of it, why aren't they otherwise unaware?
Your Honor, I think that in that...
I understand that you're saying that that's not what happened, but...
Your Honor, to that question, it's possible, but that's not the evidence that we have in this record, and that's why that particular scenario cannot be used to find that this conviction is legally sufficient. Additionally, if we're looking at it in the light most favorable to the government, that's not what they were trying to show. They were trying to show that she's completely out in this case. And I think that that needs to be taken into account when we're considering legal sufficiency.
Counsel, you were saying that in regard to the testimony of appellant that the panel could have considered it completely true or completely false. But when we're looking at the appellate level, can't cherry-picking of facts go on?
Your Honor, even if there was cherry-picking occurred, it's our position that anything that he said combined with anything that he says does not come to this middle ground of otherwise unaware. His version is aware and a complete defense, reasonable mistake of fact. Hers is completely asleep or unconscious. And there's nothing that would come at the time of the actual sexual contact. So not at the time, throughout the night, through the party, and I see my time has expired.
You can complete your response.
At the time of the party, even when PFCDS, your daughter, goes to sleep, at the time of when the alleged sexual contact occurred, PFC Brantley's version is she was aware. SR's version is that she was completely unconscious.
Well, our version be that she seemed aware to him, but she doesn't remember it. And that's why she thinks she was unconscious.
Your Honor, I think that a rational fact finder, that would be too big of a stretch for a rational fact finder, based on the record, based on what they are instructed, based on what the government was trying to prove.
You're saying that would be irrational?
I don't think that a reasonable fact finder could come to that conclusion. Pending any further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 1 p.m. this afternoon.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 1 o'clock.